30% of his base is with him. But 70% of Americans still believe immigration is a good thing for this country.
Mixed reviews on the State of the Union. It's Friday, February 8th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernard in Washington. Also ahead, bringing peace to Afghanistan, attracting tourists to India, and hosting a flock of non-human immigrants in Los Angeles. That's all ahead on today's VOA Asia. In the wake of President Donald Trump's State of the Union address on Tuesday, members of both U.S. political parties are trying to assess how to move forward under divided government. But if the president's speech is any guide, it is likely that more partisan warfare with opposition Democrats lies ahead in 2019. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has that story.
For President Trump, it was a night of mixed messages. On one hand, an open appeal to Democrats to work together.
There is a new opportunity in American politics if only we have the courage together to seize it.
But shortly thereafter, a warning to Democrats eager to push investigations of the Trump White House.
If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
During the speech, Trump pressed hard for his border wall to fight illegal immigration, a core campaign promise. But he faced strong pushback on the issue from Democrats seated before him, including many women members dressed in white, the new faces of the Trump resistance. Representative Pramila Jayapal is from Washington State.
30% of his base is with him, but 70% of Americans still believe immigration is a good thing for this country. People do not believe we should have a wall at the southern border.
America is committed to ending illegal immigration.
Trump's focus on immigration was a sure sign he has the 2020 presidential election on his mind, says Brookings analyst Bill Galston.
His language on the wall sounded like a campaign speech. So I suspect in the end that the speech will do a lot more to please his core supporters than to attract new ones.
Trump's approval rating remains stuck down near 40%. The president did get boisterous support from Republicans inside the House chamber on Tuesday, but still faces a divided electorate, says expert James Thurber on VOA's Plugged In.
I mean, we're highly polarized. He's a populist president appealing to his base. He did a good job. It was almost like a campaign speech. And this is not going to change America. America is highly polarized.
Trump lost ground in the polls in the wake of the recent government shutdown, where he got more of the blame than did congressional Democrats. The president now needs to keep his political base loyal more than ever, says Bill Galston.
The president is in for a rough 2019. He's facing congressional investigations, the Mueller report, and he may have decided that the most important thing in the immediate future is to make sure his base remains firmly attached to him and highly mobilized.
Trump did get a boost in some instant polls right after the speech, but given the new complexities of divided government with Democratic control of the House, the president now faces some daunting political challenges as he heads into his own re-election battle next year. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. A new report by the United Nations claims that North Korea is working to ensure that its weapons cannot be destroyed by military strikes. A Christian woman who spent 8 years on death row in Pakistan on charges of blasphemy is expected to leave the country. High-level talks between the United States and China are set to resume next week in hopes of ending an escalating trade war. And the Taliban is reported to have killed up to 40 government troops in separate attacks in northern Afghanistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. President Donald Trump included the possibility of peace in Afghanistan during his State of the Union speech on Tuesday. But that possibility has drawn doubt among quite a few experts. Our Ira Melman asked Benjamin Hopkins, director of Asian Studies at George Washington University in Washington, about his reservations.
I think there's long been a need to engage in peace negotiations. I think the problem with the current administration approach is that I don't see the fundamental calculus of the Taliban as a potential peace partner changing in terms of what they want. It seems like the only party that's changed their attitude is the United States under the Trump administration, and the real change has just been a desire to get out.
Are you saying that you just don't trust the Taliban?
I don't think the Taliban's interests have changed, I guess is how I would characterize it. I don't think their public statements or their public interest in terms of what they are seeking, which is essentially a withdrawal of American troops, has changed. I think if there's been a shift in the party's positions, it's been the American willingness under the Trump administration to withdraw from Afghanistan.
How much do you think Donald Trump, the president of the United States, wants those troops out as opposed to what might happen if they do go?
I have not seen any public statements from the administration indicating that there has been a serious discussion of what happens afterwards in terms of if the United States were to withdraw its forces from Afghanistan, what that would mean, number one, for the Afghan government, but number two, for American interest in the region. Now, those conversations could be taking place privately behind the scenes, but there's not been a whole lot of movement in terms of administration policy in this region that would give me a lot of confidence in those conversations happening.
If U.S. troops did withdraw, even a partial withdrawal, how do you paint, what kind of picture do you paint for Afghanistan?
Well, the security of the Afghan government, the security and viability of the Afghan government, as presently constituted, is dependent on the continuation of an American troop deployment in the country. I think almost every observer and commentator would recognize that. And I think most importantly, the Taliban recognizes that. If the United States were to withdraw completely, I think that would put significant question marks over the viability of the Afghan government.
What about the refusal of the Taliban so far in any of these so-called peace talks to talk with the current Afghanistan government?
I think this is a big problem, and it also shows where they believe, quite correctly, the power militarily in the current situation to lie, namely with the United States. And I think the Taliban has always believed and continues to believe that only with the United States out of the way can they militarily defeat the Afghan government. As long as American troops are in the country, they cannot win an armed conflict. But getting the United States out of the way, out of the country, would open up that possibility, especially with regard to a pretty weak Afghan government.
That's just a continuation, then, of what's happened in Afghanistan for centuries, right?
No, I wouldn't say for centuries. It's definitely a continuation of what's happened over the past 18 years. I mean, part of the problem that the Trump administration has both inherited but doubled down on is a lack of clear objective for the United States. There has not been one enunciated since shortly after the fall of the Taliban in 2001. Neither the Bush administration, nor the Obama administration, nor now the Trump administration has clearly articulated a war aim and purpose in Afghanistan. And it's very hard to declare objectives met and thus a victory won when you don't have a clear publicly acknowledged aim that you're fighting for.
Benjamin Hopkins is director of Asian Studies at George Washington University here in Washington. Happening now in Asia, stocks were mixed on Thursday. Japan's Nikkei 225 slipped 0.59%, while the topics declined 0.83%. SoftBank Group soared 17% on the back of its announcement on Wednesday that it would purchase up to 600 billion yen of stock in its largest ever buyback. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us here on VOA Asia. India's southern state of Kerala was one of the country's top tourist attractions until the worst rains in a century caused widespread devastation last year and scared away visitors. The region of charming coastal plains and low-lying mountains is racing to rebuild a tourism sector that contributes nearly 10% to its economy. But environmentalists are urging more sustainable development. Anjana Pasricha has this report from Kerala.
Many of the traditional wooden houseboats that were a big draw for Indian and foreign tourists on the palm-fringed inland lagoons in Kerala are standing idle during the peak season. This houseboat owner in the tropical backwaters in Alappuzha waits for visitors, but their numbers have dwindled after the most intense rains in a century triggered devastating floods last August.
Last month, I was just really feeling bad because on last December, we can get good money and good business, and some good, a lot of business in this world. But in 2018 is going down.
A tourist boom in recent years created tens of thousands of jobs. But despite the receding flood waters, work has been slow.
2 months, 3 months salary is pending. Because of we don't have enough guests here, we don't have enough income.
Vowing to revive tourism, authorities are racing to restore damaged infrastructure in the plains and in Kerala's popular hill areas, where verdant hillsides had crumbled into brown rubble due to landslides. Anoop Murali, who left his small family farm to work in the city, is happy that damaged roads are being rebuilt and widened. It is along these roads that he ferries tourists to scenic places covered with tea plantations, such as Munnar.
This is our bread and butter. Many people are like me. There was no much opportunity to work in a farm because it is not much earning.
As it overcomes the ravages of the floods, Kerala is hoping to top the 1 million foreign and 15 million domestic tourists who came in 2017. Environmentalists, however, caution that cutting fragile hillsides and diverting farmlands to build roads and resorts to accommodate visitors contributed to intensifying the flooding.
The urbanization and development that has happened has taken over a significant portion of area, ecologically sensitive area, which could have, you know, distributed water evenly or even allowed water to go inside the ground. Infrastructure is being built without considering the movement of water. Okay, so for example, they are constructing roads without giving way for water to pass under the road. So, they're constructing fast, but my fear is that most of the roads are going to again become an embankment.
Others say tourism is their lifeline.
People are struggling now because somehow guests should understand that Kerala is 100% safe, and we all welcome them to our point for our survival and better business.
With such voices ringing out, Kerala faces a challenge in ensuring sustainable development as it rebuilds. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, Kerala.
And you're listening to VOA Asia.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
This news alert from VOA Asia, a 27-year-old Indian man plans to sue his parents for giving birth to him without his consent. Mumbai businessman Raphael Samuel told the BBC that it's wrong to bring children into the world because they then have to put up with lifelong suffering. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. And VOA Asia continues. At sunset every day, an almost deafening sound from the sky can be heard in a community just east of Los Angeles. It's the sound of parrots that have become a familiar part of life there. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more.
What do these parrots and turtles have in common? Many of them are descendants of pets who immigrated to this urban jungle. Southern California is not their native homeland.
That is their outdoor voice, by the way. They are not quiet birds, so...
Ursula Heise is a professor at the UCLA Institute of the Environment and Sustainability and a bird lover. She's rescued and adopted some of these birds.
They come originally from northeastern Mexico, from the state of Tamaulipas, where they are now endangered.
As transplants to Southern California, these red-crowned parrots have thrived in the wild. They have become such a permanent fixture here that they are recognized by the California Bird Records Committee.
They've been naturalized as California citizens.
Similarly, these red-eared slider turtles, originally from the central United States, have adapted and thrived. They are now found across America and around the world. The success of these turtles and parrots in the Los Angeles area have some academics wondering whether a city can be a place to help endangered non-native animals, like a zoo, but better, say experts.
At least it's living in the wild. It's making its own living. It's having the lifestyle that that turtle or that parrot should have. It's just doing it in a different place.
We have put up major buildings. We've put expanses of concrete. We've introduced a completely different vegetation. And in many cases, that's led to a reduction of biodiversity because a lot of our created habitat is not hospitable to the native species. But the other side of that is that we've created new ecological niches and new kinds of habitats.
Conservation professor Brad Schaefer says non-native species would have to be carefully selected to ensure it does not harm the existing wildlife population in the city and beyond.
There's always that danger. And I think the real question is, can we minimize that danger by doing sort of the best possible ecological science to be able to identify species that will thrive in cities and won't thrive outside of cities?
Schaefer says species will migrate outside their native environment, potentially causing harm. He believes it might be better to carefully select a species to introduce as long as it's not harming biodiversity in a city. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Women-only taxis equipped with child car seats and taxis unable to refuse passengers based on their destinations will begin running in Seoul as early as this month. All the big stories coming your way throughout the day on VOA. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, an ongoing partnership to provide new health posts in rural Rwanda is making access to health care a reality for many families. In 2018, S.C. Johnson Company established 10 health posts in Rwanda. Stephen Hogan is Senior Director of Global Public Affairs and Communication for S.C. Johnson. He spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about the significance of the new initiative.
Malaria is one issue that is important to us. It's obviously, you know, one of the biggest killers in the world. And because of our pest control expertise, we're one of the largest manufacturers of pest control products in the world. And through our Center for Insect Science and Family Health, I think we're uniquely positioned to bring our expertise to bear against mosquito-borne disease. The program we have in Rwanda is part of that much larger effort that we have to combat malaria and mosquito-borne disease. We work in many parts of the world. In particular, Rwanda has been a great partner of ours. We've been working with them for more than 4 years. They have a very progressive, stable government. They've been fantastic to work with. And I think the health posts that we're supporting there are uniquely suited to helping to provide the tools and education needed to combat malaria.
Why are these health posts, what makes them unique?
The thing that makes them unique and the thing that you don't see in many parts of the world is they're very small posts. Kind of they're the first line of defense for combating disease in Rwanda. And they're really designed to be within about a 25-minute walk for most people versus, you know, a 3-hour walk for the larger health centers or hospitals. I think it's particularly important for women who are pregnant and have no other form of transportation. You know, the difference between a 25-minute walk and a 3-hour walk is probably the difference between a, you know, 100 miles. It allows us to provide the tools and education, as I said, to really help combat mosquito-borne disease in a way that other health centers cannot.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists with the U.S. National Centers for Environmental Information found that Earth's magnetic North Pole is quickly shifting from the Canadian Arctic to Siberia. Due to these unplanned variations, the U.S. agency was forced to release an updated version of its World Magnetic Model, or WMM, a year ahead of schedule. The WMM is described as a wide depiction of the Earth's magnetic field and is usually updated every 5 years. The next update wasn't due until the end of 2019. Earth's magnetic fields are generated deep in our planet's core. Scientists say the Earth's rotation causes the liquid iron core to spin and form whirlpools, producing electric currents that generate the magnetic fields. The WMM is used in a variety of applications, including accurate compass apps, maps, and GPS services. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Finally, this week, past weekend, Pride Week kicked off in full force in Myanmar's largest city, Yangon. A flurry of rainbow umbrellas dotted Yangon Harbor, held by fishermen following a flotilla of partygoers. Libby Hogan has the story.
Rainbow flags, stilettos, and a handbag throwing contest. Myanmar's first public LGBT boat parade took to Yangon's waters to celebrate the start of Pride Week.
The reason that I joined this cause, this amazing cause, is because as an actor myself, I've been seeing a lot of misrepresentations in the movies, especially from the gay community or LGBT or trans community. And, you know, these people were always depicted as the jokes. So as an actor myself, I'm here to make people think about this.
Hundreds turned out to support the celebrations and watch the Drag Olympics. But off the stage, activists made urgent calls to abolish a law that criminalizes homosexuality. Activist Shin Thant was crowned Miss Transgender winner last year in Myanmar. She hopes to use her fame to draw attention to the cause.
Every month I am meeting with Myanmar parliamentarians, member and government ministry to change the rules and law and policy.
Shin Thant hopes more events like this one will be held across the country.
And that's VOA Asia for today and for this week. Thanks so much for being with us. We hope you'll join us again next week.